Welcome to the Vip Jaswal Report, the report that asks insightful questions and gets revealing answers. Today, we discuss some of the challenges Muslims face in America and around the world. Our guest is the eminent Dr. Waleed Farez, who is a contributor and Middle East analyst for Fox News. Waleed is also an advisor to the U.S. Congress and teaches political science at various Washington universities. Welcome to the show, Waleed.
Thank you, Vip. Thank you for having me on your great show.
According to Muslim scholars, the word Islam means safeness and peace. So let me start by asking, what's the difference between an Islamist and a Muslim?
That's a great question. The public needs to understand that there is a big difference. A Muslim is a member of the Islamic community, has faith in the religion of Islam. There are 1.5 or 1.2 billion Muslims around the world in 52 or 54 countries. There are various sects, different theologies. That's what it means to be a Muslim, member of a religion of a community. Islamists is something else. It is an individual or a group that belongs to an ideology, to a political doctrine. They call themselves al-Islamiyin in Arabic, or les Islamistes in French, or Islamists in English.
With frequent violence occurring in the Arab world, Africa, and Asia, these are challenging times for Muslim communities globally, and in a sense, also in America. In particular, I've noticed a large segment of the Muslim American political establishment has been critical of American policy abroad, but at the same time, hasn't necessarily defended the U.S. campaigns against the terrorists overseas. Can you explain why this is the case?
Well, we have to understand that Muslim Americans are a very large set of communities that come from different ethnic and national backgrounds, with different political issues abroad. They have political factions that are very critical of U.S. foreign policy, as other communities have. And they have political factions, maybe not leading political factions, that are very supportive of those U.S. foreign policy actions in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere. So we need to understand that the political establishment within the community reflects not the religion, not the faith, it reflects the political distribution of these factions. And that's why the American public has seen critics of U.S. foreign policy, maybe with a louder voice, but there are very many factions that are supportive of U.S. policy, depending on which administration.
Another observation I have is that I don't see significant political leadership from the community. There is no one person to represent in whole the interests of the ordinary American Muslim. Doesn't this lack of visual leadership actually harm the image of the ordinary American Muslim?
Well, definitely, if there is a national leadership of any community, that would be always better in terms of seeking better rights, in terms of seeking better representation. But look at all other communities. You don't have a one person that represents them, the Italian Americans, the Irish Americans, the Lebanese Americans, the Syrian Americans, or others, or even Hispanic Americans. What is lacking basically in that political establishment is a voice that would express the diversity. We see one opinion, one major opinion coming through the administration, through Congress and the media. What we need to see more within the community is a diversity of opinion, giving, I would say, affirmative action to those who do not have a capacity of expressing their opinion. They don't have the media, they don't have the funding. So what we need now is actually more diversity than less diversity in the community.
We've also seen a rise in the domestic Islamist or the jihadist-inspired terrorism over the past 4 years, such as the Fort Hood massacre and some cases of affiliation with the jihadists. Why is there a rise domestically?
Well, that's a different question that has to do with what we mentioned before, an ideology. That ideology has been determined as a jihadist ideology. It could have roots such as Salafi jihadists, that would be Al-Qaeda, for example, or a Taliban overseas. Or nowadays, as we're seeing in Mali, the fight against that specific faction. These are movements that are built on doctrines and political ideologies that describe themselves as jihadists. That ideology has not been countered, unfortunately. What has been countered very successfully, though, within the United States to certain limits, are basically the actions of the terrorists. Meaning, if we know of a preparation by a cell, should it be Islamist or non-Islamist, doesn't matter. Our law enforcement has been very, very good and efficient. The problem is that we have not had a strategy over the past 4, 5, and maybe 6 years that would counter radicalization, indoctrination. We see 80% of those that we have captured or arrested before they implement their action. And unfortunately, in the case of Fort Hood, after they implemented their action, they are inspired by a doctrine. So what is happening right now is that we are not identifying the ideology, and that is the problem.
So are we being reactive as opposed to proactive?
We are now reactive in the sense we only intervene when we see that action is about to happen, which is what we need to do. But we are not basically countering with other means than law enforcement, with cultural means, with social means, the rise of indoctrination. There is a doctrine, as I said earlier, and it has a web. We need to basically tell the community, tell all communities, tell the national public, Congress needs to work on this, administration needs to work on this, that this is an ideology that basically would lead to terrorism. That is the establishment of fundamentalist views of distinguishing between women and males. That is to create the concept of infidel scaffold. All these notions, which in the Middle East are well known as the product of the jihadists, are not really attended to here in the United States, unfortunately.
Do the fundamentalists worldwide and in America distort the image of the ordinary American Muslim?
There is no doubt about it that jihadists worldwide, Salafi jihadists or Khomeinist jihadists, those who follow the line of the Iranian leadership, of course they distort the good image of Muslim communities around the world. But let me add that the principal fights in the Muslim world is mostly between, you know, Muslims who are against the jihadists, those who demonstrate, for example, in Egypt against the Salafists, those who have demonstrated in Libya after the Benghazi attack. Who are they? They are Muslims who are against the jihadists. And same can be seen today in Mali as we speak. You have the Mali government or the African government, most of whom have the, you know, majority of Muslims fighting against Al-Qaeda. So the jihadists are distorting the real image of what Muslim societies have been trying to do in countering the extremists.
You've written a book called Future Jihad, Terrorist Strategies Against America, the War of Ideas, and the Confrontation. So let's start with the killing of bin Laden. The Obama administration claimed that with the killing of bin Laden, Al-Qaeda is on the decline. Waleed, in your opinion, is that a fair assessment?
I do not believe that this is a fair assessment, and I'm going to explain why. It's very important for the American public, basically, to understand the link between the elimination of bin Laden, which is and was an act of justice. The man led terrorist attacks against the United States, killing thousands of Americans and tens of thousands with his allies around the world against other societies, including Muslim societies and non-Muslim societies. So the elimination of bin Laden, historically speaking, is an act of justice. Any administration should have carried that act of justice, and it was done, and we're thankful that it was done. But to say that with the killing of bin Laden, Al-Qaeda is going down or on its path to decline or basically has been strategically eliminated is not correct in view of the facts on the ground. First of all, Al-Qaeda and their allies, the Taliban, are still omnipresent in Pakistan. We are about to negotiate with the Taliban, at least in a, you know, indirect way in Afghanistan, which means that they are still on the ground even in Afghanistan. But more important than that, Al-Qaeda now has a much bigger presence in Yemen than under the times of the leadership of bin Laden. They are seizing villages. Al-Qaeda as Shabab, Jihad al-Shabab, or Shabab Jihad in Somalia is bigger. And more worrisome is what's happening in North Africa. In Mali, today as we speak, there is a fight between the international community and a form of Al-Qaeda that has controlled a large segment of the country, as large probably as England. And of course, in Libya, after Benghazi, we realized that Al-Qaeda is there. So across the world, Al-Qaeda is growing because, again, of the ideology. And it's not because of the killing of bin Laden that we can see today that it is on the path of decline. This was an important act, but we need to have a war of ideas. We need to have an international coalition to make sure that the next generation that Al-Qaeda can indoctrinate should not be indoctrinated.
One thing that concerns me in the killing of bin Laden is that we seem to have done nothing for the doctor who helped us succeed in capturing bin Laden. He's rotting in jail while we're rejoicing. doesn't that negatively impact our future strategy? Because we're never going to get help from foreigners in capturing terrorists that way.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an example that shows that our policy doesn't take into consideration the full-fledged support of societies that could help us in the future. This is an individual who has been part, actually, of this victory, of this success, of the elimination of the man who led terror attacks against us and against the entire world. Now to see him in jail, and according to some reports, even roughed up and maybe hit by his security jailers.
Well, tortured actually
is something that would hurt the image of America. I mean, in the future, who is going to help us if we see that we do not stick with our people to support us or with our friends in the world?
So my next question is then, why are we still providing aid to Pakistan? What am I missing here?
Well, that's the problem. Pakistan is at fight with the Taliban, but the fight is very limited. The Pakistani government, army, intelligence services are just pushing back against the Taliban. They're not completing the job. It's been years that the United States has been sending billions of dollars to Pakistan, to the previous government, military government, to this government. And we have not seen a strategic decision by the country to finish off the Taliban, meaning to send the army all the way to the borders and pacify that. Is it that they cannot, or is it that they should not? Is there a corruption, or is there something else? So I think that Congress should rethink and renegotiate the package deal that we are sending to the Pakistanis, because this is a lot of money and we need to see results on the ground.
In 2014, the U.S. and NATO are going to leave Afghanistan. What do you think will happen? Because that might be the perfect opportunity for the jihadists to grab power.
Well, look, most experts in the region, about the region, on both sides of the Atlantic and, of course, in Afghanistan, do tell us that because we have not partnered with civil society in Afghanistan and created what I call an Afghan Spring, meaning a resistance against the Taliban, a resistance in civil society before it should be a resistance in the armed forces, what we're going to see is the day we are going to be leaving Afghanistan is the day for the Taliban to return to where they were before. They were going to try to seize all the areas in the south or southeast of Afghanistan. They're going to try to get close from Kabul. They're going to try to dismantle the government of Afghanistan. What worries me is a reversal that the Taliban could do against the rights, the acquired rights by women on the one hand and minorities and civil society in general terms.
If the Taliban grab power, should America return?
Well, first of all, the United States should revise its whole strategy against the Taliban, against the jihadists worldwide. What we see is a general, I would even say a generalized retreat from engaging all jihadists across the map. Look at Benghazi, for example. We're still asking questions, why are we not responding? The French are responding in Mali to many actions that the jihadists there have taken. And we seem to be thinking that by retreating from the jihadists, they will seize those countries and will normalize with us. I would say the Taliban will take over, and if this current U.S. policy continues, you know, we may consider it as a fact. It could continue. And that is going to lead to abuse of human rights, and then our public is going to be debating the issue again. What have we done in Afghanistan? You know, a decade plus of being present there, of spending time and money and blood for the return of the jihadists who are going to take away the rights obtained by women or by civil society. That is going to be a big debate about it in Washington.
Well, Wally, is Afghanistan as a country ready to embrace their own independence without the presence of NATO and the USA as a so-called bodyguard?
You know, I don't think that Afghanistan as it is right now, if not equipped, if not enabled to respond to the Taliban threat that is still around, meaning if we had reduced the Taliban threat, including ideologically, then the Afghan government could more or less produce an acceptable quasi-stable country. My concern is that if quit as the stage as I see right now, I mean, it's a mathematical equation. They don't have the capacity of stopping the Taliban from at least taking back some of the areas inside the country and even trying to bring down the government in Kabul. They may be, i.e. the Afghani forces, able to keep some areas in Afghanistan while the Taliban will take other areas. So what is needed right now is, if we want to withdraw, we need to have a regional understanding. We need to include more countries. It's not just Pakistan. We need to include India. We need to include Russia. We need to include, you know, many other international players in the stabilization of Afghanistan. Because if the Taliban will take back, if not all of Afghanistan, at least part of it, they're going to recreate an international jihadi network that would work against all countries, not just the United States.
You're famous for your prediction of the Arab Spring in your most recent book called The Coming Revolution, Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East. What do the words Arab Spring mean? How was it derived?
Well, this was derived basically from what has happened in Eastern and Central Europe against the Soviets, the Spring of Prague or the Spring of Czechoslovakia, when people uprised in the streets against totalitarian regimes. But each spring has the option of being successful and becoming a summer, blooming summer, or it also has the option of becoming a winter. In the Middle East, when those young men and women took to the streets of Tunisia, and specifically in Cairo, in Tahrir Square, and showed for the first time that civil societies do not want to continue to be under the oppression of the authoritarian dictators, those who are pro-American and those who are anti-American, as we saw in Syria, for example, then the term Arab Spring was adopted, but without understanding that this was an Arab Spring in its beginning, but those forces that seized it later are now transforming it into a Arab winter.
You know, some people claim that the Arab Spring will transform the Middle East, but at the moment it seems like one big mess. Isn't this an ideal opportunity again for more fundamentalist governments to take advantage of this power vacuum?
Yes, it is. And that's what is happening right now. In the book, The Coming Revolution, Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East, which I've published in the summer of 2010, and I've projected two things. Number one, that civil societies in the Arab world, after what happened in Iran in 2009, the rise against the Ayatollahs by the youth, after what happened in Beirut in 2005, the Cedars Revolution against the Syrian occupation, against Hezbollah, the Arab world, Arab civil societies taking advantage, at least in their, you know, youth segment of internet, of laptop, of Google, of Facebook, of YouTube, of all these networks, social media, Facebook, are rising. We're rising against their society, against their regimes. In Egypt, for example, the first waves of the Arab Spring were secular, were youth, and they expressed it in the media. The problem has been that at one point when these societies needed the help, the identification by the international community to move forward in the process, the Islamist forces, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example, the Nahda in Tunisia, the Salafi networks in Libya, and of course now as we see the disaster in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood or the Salafi militia, jihadi militias in Syria, have all moved forward to try to seize these revolts. That's what the American public needs to understand, that initially the first wave was made of good people, those who, you know, think alike in terms of democracy and pluralism. A second wave underneath came and has been seizing those revolts in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and beyond. And we, the United States, unfortunately, have sided with the Brotherhood, have sided with the Islamists, thinking that they are the reformists, while, in fact, as the Egyptian new opposition is telling us today, the Brotherhood or the Salafists or the Nahda forces are the ones who are going to impose another authoritarian regime, unfortunately.
So what you're saying is the Arab Spring began as a form of civil society movement, but it's now ended up in the hands of more Islamist factions?
Yes, indeed. It was very clear that the first waves were made of young people, women, minorities, middle class, labor, reformists, seculars, and even conservative religious, but not fundamentalists. And gradually in 2011, as of the mid and end of 2011, the more organized, better funded, better supported, and unfortunately, we've partnered with those. These are the Islamists, political Islamists in a sense, were the ones who competed with the youth, maneuvered well, and sees the parliament in Egypt, the presidency now are pushing back against the judiciary. Same thing happened in Tunisia. But the good news is that civil societies have not gone down. They are still struggling. So I do project in the future that there will be another wave of civil society rise, including Muslim political factions that are reformist and opposed to the fundamentalists.
But it's all going to get very messy, isn't it? You're not going to know who's actually taking a stand.
Well, basically, the problem in America is that most of this narrative is happening in Arabic. If you watch Arabic channels, you will see the picture very clear. If you speak the language, you would understand the drama happening in Egypt. There are actors, there are intellectuals, there are people 24/7 in Egypt telling the world what's happening. The problem, if I may say, is that our media, the international media, and most specifically the American media, at least most of the mainstream media, is not explaining to the public that you have a rise of youth that are objecting to the rise of Islamist fundamentalist regimes in the region.
But in some way, shape, or form, does this show that the Middle East might not be ready as yet for an extreme change in the style of government?
If you compare with any other society that went through the political process of revolutions and reforms, look at France, for example. France had one revolution, then the return of the monarchy and empires under Napoleon, then again a second and a third, until they became stable under a secular republic. The Arab world now, or since at least 2011, experienced the first wave of democratic revolutions, democratic revolts, may I say, not very well organized. Then a second wave came back and took over and is moving the Arab world towards fundamentalism. I do expect a third wave to come, and we see part of it in Egypt, in Tunisia, and maybe in other countries, to reestablish the real norms of the Arab Spring.
America doesn't necessarily have a great record of success in the Middle East. Take, for example, Syria. You know, after two full years of civil war, we still haven't been able to do much. Is there a lesson to be learned here?
Oh, absolutely. The issue of Syria is dramatic, is tragic, actually. About 40,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed by the Assad regime, an ally of the Iranian regime, an ally of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and an ally of radical forces in Iraq. So on the one hand, the civilian population in Syria, not supported by the international community, is being massacred by the Syrian regime. And on the other hand, the other bad news is that because we were so late in doing anything about Syria, now you have jihadists, you have Al-Qaeda that is penetrating the opposition in Syria. The entire opposition is not Islamist. There are many secular, many liberal, many democracy forces in Syria, but they're not the ones who have the guns. They're not the ones who have the funding. Most of the support, unfortunately, is going to the jihadi forces inside Syria. We failed in 2011 when we had a better geopolitical situation. Remember, America and its allies were still in Iraq in 2011, and Assad was surrounded. Iraq to the east, Turkey to the north, Jordan to the south. We are present in the eastern Mediterranean. Unfortunately, when we withdrew from Iraq abruptly, then the Iranians, if you look at the map, it's very easy to understand. The Iranians through Iraq are now supplying Assad with the support, and Assad is getting that support from Hezbollah in Lebanon. So now it is much more difficult, very difficult, for the international community to intervene on behalf of the Syrian people as we did in Libya or in Kosovo or elsewhere.
So Al-Qaeda is taking advantage of the weakness in our strategy.
Al-Qaeda, everywhere we go, is taking an advantage, even after the killing of Bin Laden, mm-hmm. which responds to the previous question. Look, for example, in Libya. We did help the rebels very much from the air, from the sea, training. Our allies have sent them weapons. What we have not done was to distinguish in this rebel force between those who are going to become secular in the future, like former bureaucrats, former diplomats, former units of the Libyan army, who all rose against Gaddafi and the civil society on the one hand. And on the other hand, we had those Islamist militias, the Salafi militias, who were also fighting against Gaddafi, but not to reestablish a liberal democracy. It was to bring down a dictator and to establish in its place, on its same base of power, an Islamist regime. And that's what they have been trying to do in eastern Libya. And if I may say how dramatic it was, one of these militias, the Islamist militia of Benghazi, is responsible for the attack in Benghazi. So when you don't pay attention during a process of a political change in the Middle East or in the Arab world, you would allow al-Qaeda to be armed during the insurrections, to grow, and when time will come to disarm all militias, they refuse. So we have to be very careful in Syria when we are talking about arming the opposition. Which opposition are we talking about? We need it to be visible. We need to know their leaders. We need to engage with those who are going to guarantee that there will be a democracy and a protection of women and minorities and civil society in the future.
And finally, based on your successful prediction of the Arab Spring, what are your predictions for the state of affairs for 2013 in the Middle East?
Look, 2013, Vip, has been already decided and determined by how we ended 2012. And if we do a quick overview of what do we expect in the next few months, the 11 months and a half of 2013, in Tunisia, the government is Islamist, but you are going to be seeing a lot of secular demonstrations. There is a very strong labor union, very strong women's movement in Tunisia. They are not very happy with the kind of legislation, call them Sharia-based, narrow Sharia-based legislation that the Nahda party is trying to impose, meaning you're going to see trouble in Tunisia in 2013. In Libya, it may be a little bit more difficult. These Islamist militias, one of which, as I said, were responsible for the attack in Benghazi, are not going to disarm. Somebody has to disarm them. And this is the dilemma of it. If you don't disarm them, they're going to grow. They're going to try to grab the government, to seize all of Libya. And Libya, Vip, has a lot of money because, potentially speaking, it has exportation of oil to Europe. So you're going to see trouble in Libya between an al-Qaeda-inspired Salafi armed movement that is going to try to seize the government and a government that is going to try to disarm them. And it all depends on what we're going to do. Are we going to help the government, part of the secular government, or are we not going to help in this endeavor? In Egypt, I've already mentioned that the Muslim Brotherhood government led by President Morsi is going to try to impose an Islamist regime. It is not our analysis. It's basically the analysis of the opposition, of the very wide secular opposition. I see many demonstrations and trouble in Egypt. If you move to Syria, I cannot see any way how in the next at least 6 months, I can project 6 months, we're going to be able, as international community, as United States, with the current situation, with the Iranian backing, with Russia's veto in the Security Council, to stop it. So, unfortunately, it's bad news for Syria, at least for the next few months, until Washington really decides what it wants to do in the region. And if we move to Iran, this is where the real trouble is for the United States and the international community. We are not stopping the Iranian nukes. We are not stopping their strategic weaponry system, meaning they are developing their long-range, medium-range missiles. They are doing exercise with those. And in addition, they are increasing their penetration of Iraq, of Lebanon, of Syria. They're trying to destabilize Saudi Arabia and, of course, Bahrain. They are present in Yemen. I don't see in 2013 how, if we begin today by changing our policy, which has not been very successful, our sanctions are efficient, but our sanctions are not complete with regard to Iran. And let me end with Iraq and Lebanon quickly. In Iraq, there is a descent into violence. Every day we see more violence between the sectarian factions. And in Lebanon, there is an increase of power of Hezbollah. So it is really unfortunate that I would say that 2013 is not going to be a year where the Middle East is going to be moving towards peace further. And on the other hand, the only good piece of news is that youth and civil societies in 2013 are going to prepare themselves probably for 2014 and 15 to express themselves and to tell the world that they need a new, free, democratic Middle East.
One question I have, in all of the whole of the Middle East, why is the Emirates isolated or insulated from all of this?
If we look at the Gulf in general, from Kuwait to Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and Oman, they have been insulated from the Arab Spring. Saudi Arabia, it has an authoritarian regime, it has a special situation, being a leader in the Muslim world. But even Saudi Arabia has been threatened by the Iranians on the one hand, who are instigating a lot of trouble in the eastern provinces, the oil-rich provinces, and the Saudis are very concerned about that. And on the other hand, Al-Qaeda, which is moving to Saudi from Yemen. So all is interconnected. Now, the Gulf states, one by one, seem to be stable so far, but not completely insulated in the process. Kuwait is now very concerned about two threats, and that's along the line of all other principalities. Iran, on the one hand, is threatening the stability of Kuwait. It has many supporters inside Kuwait. And Al-Qaeda and the Salafists are pushing up in Kuwait. So they are sandwiched, they're crushed between these two pressures. If you go to Bahrain, you see a similar situation. The Bahraini government, being mostly Sunni, is pressured now by an opposition that is mostly Shia. Part of the opposition is legitimate civil society. The other part of it is also manipulated or backed by the Iranian regime. Now, the Arab Emirates, the United Arab Emirates, has been so far the most shielded from all these changes because probably, as some experts have told us, of the amount of investment that everybody has in the UAE. They were very smart to accept investment from Iran, from the Arab world. But recently they have been complaining about and actually making arrests of Muslim Brotherhood cells. It's all over the UAE media. And they are concerned that after having controlled Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood may well push to the UAE and try to destabilize it. And remaining is Oman in the south of the Arabian Peninsula that is also possibly under the pressure of Iranian influence on the one hand and Al-Qaeda coming from Yemen on the other hand.
Well, where can we get more of your valuable insight into the affairs of the Middle East?
Well, thank you very much. If listeners or readers are interested in more of this analysis, they could simply go to my website. It is www.walidfaris.com. You've got to spell it right, WALID Faris, PHARES.com. And you'll find all the information about my books, my videos, and my lectures. And I would like to thank you so much for this opportunity today, Vip.
Thank you for coming on the show, Walid. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is it for today. Thank you for listening. Feel free to send in your comments to our Facebook page at facebook.com/Fox News Radio or tweet us at Fox News Radio on Twitter. I'm your host, Vip Jaswal, and keep your ears open for the next airing of the Vip Jaswal Report coming soon.